Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 21 of A Year-Long Conversation. Today we're going to be talking about, is Bernie Sanders the new Ron Paul or a political poet? And joining me as always is Blue in Alabama's Michael. Michael, what can we really say about this guy that hadn't already been said? What's it going to take to get this bit out of the race?
I said it before and I'll say it again. It's going to take him dying.
I can see somebody making a political short film. Bernie Sanders must die. And it is kill Bernie. Look, nobody's saying that he should die or that we want him to die or that it even will happen. People like that don't get assassinated. Nobody's going to kill a 75-year-old man. We talk about Bernie sporadically, but this is really the second episode that we've done kind of specifically about him. And the first episode was about him and Trump, so we kind of split it. So this is going to be unique in that we spend pretty much the whole episode talking about him. But we have to, because the race really shifted to the general election a couple of weeks ago, but Bernie didn't get that message. And so it's kind of weird that, like, Hillary is still fighting a primary and Trump's been allowed to move on to the generals. So I feel like if there was ever a time to talk about Bernie, it would be now, because I'm hoping he's not going to be in the race much longer.
Yeah, I hope he's not. But by the way things are going, I don't see him leaving anytime soon.
Kentucky and Oregon are going to vote, and I think going to give Hillary enough delegates that she needs. And Trump's had it to himself for about 2 weeks because his opponents dropped out. So she's still, like, closer to her nomination than Trump is. Even though Trump's, all his competition, like after Indiana, it was like, nope, peace, we surrender. They actually had a plausible plan to keep Trump from his nomination. Bernie doesn't. There's really no way Hillary's not going to be the nominee. And I believe this Tuesday, Oregon and Kentucky, they have about 130 delegates between them. You think after May 17th and after the results come in and after she's got that 2383, that weird number that they decided on that you got to have for the nomination, once she gets 2383, do you think Bernie will get the message?
I think he's already got the message. His whole argument right now, he's wanting to go to the convention to be able to have some type of say on the party platform. That's his biggest goal right now. Because he knows he's not going to get the nomination.
You would think.
The thing is, he won West Virginia. Okay, he won 51% of the vote in West Virginia or something like that.
Right.
And the percentage that he needed went up. He's got to win 66% of all the remaining delegates. And now it's even higher after winning West Virginia because he didn't win by at least 66%. So now he's got to have like 70% of the remaining delegates. So there's no way he's going to get there, and I think he knows that.
What you're saying is exactly right, and this is so hard to explain to his fans. You can win and still lose, and they're touting West Virginia, some of the states that he's won recently, and it still doesn't matter because he's not winning them by enough of a margin. Like you're saying, every state he doesn't win by 66%, he's actually losing. He has to get basically a filibuster-proof Senate majority. You know, like, he can't just win these states by straight up and down. It can't just be 51%. It's got to be 2/3. After May 17th, there's about 5 or 6 more states that vote. Maybe he does know that he can't win, but his fans don't seem to.
Yeah, I mean, his fans, apparently you have more contacts with his fans than I do. I mean, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's me still being in Alabama, but I don't see them that much. I see one every once in a while. It's like a four-leaf clover seeing a Bernie Sanders fan. They're hard to spot.
In Alabama, he's about as popular as gum on the bottom of somebody's shoe. I mean, I don't think Bernie is really very popular in Alabama. So in Los Angeles, he is pretty popular. I do see car tags with Bernie, and I'll see Bernie stickers, and it's usually on, like, some car that's in not great condition. Let's put it that way. I mean, it's the same kind of person. Like, it's a white guy or a white girl who looks kind of older and frumpy, sort of like really low-end college professors or something, like associate professors at a community college, and they've got all this crap in their car. Their car's not well-maintained. They've got, like, stacks of trash and stuff around the edges. A lot of Bernie's fans kind of look like him in like a disheveled, not very well put together kind of way. But yeah, I see some around here. Some of them are really young. A lot of them are not as young as people say. Like, I think everybody has a mental impression of a Bernie fan as being 19. I see a lot of older 50s and early 60s kind of people. Maybe the second half of what we talked about where we say, is he a political poet? And I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. But yeah, most of my contact with them, though, is really online. When people say that they haven't had a lot of contact with his fans, I'm like, well, consider yourself lucky, because they find me. I don't find them. I'm, you know, a lot of Bernie fans, I'm like, hey, don't call me, I'll call you. And they find me anyway. his fans this week, they're like, he's going to win this thing. And, I mean, they really seem to believe that he's still in it to win it. They really don't seem to get that he's just kind of wasting everybody's time and money.
Right.
So, Bernie, I mean, there's a couple of different ways to interpret this guy. Last week, Geraldo, he had a hot mic, and he accidentally referred to Bernie as annoying. He goes, this guy is so annoying. I mean, I think Hillary fans find Bernie pretty annoying. Because it's like Hillary's got to really think about beating Trump in a general election and raising money for all these congressional seats and stuff like that. And then there Bernie is every day, Hillary voted for Iraq. She's corrupt. She's for Wall Street. It's really gone beyond the campaign, and it's hard to explain because to a lot of people, they say, well, what's wrong with democracy? And there's nothing wrong with running until you absolutely get beat, but at a certain point, you're not helping anybody. Like, you're really not. Like, all of the causes that Bernie supposedly cares about, he's actually kind of hurting them at this point by staying in so long because he's hurting the congressional candidates and the Democrats that could actually champion these causes. He's taking a lot of money and time and attention and all this stuff away from the Democratic Party. Talking about all these things that he supposedly cares about, he's gone from like an advocate for them to kind of an annoyance about them, and he may actually be getting in the way of Democrats who are going to be able to champion this in Congress.
I completely agree with that. I think that he's convinced that he's the only person that can deliver on these promises, but he doesn't realize that he has to have a Congress that would work with him to pass it. And what he doesn't realize is Congress can do this without him. If you get a progressive Congress, they can do these things. They can do some of the things that he's wanting to do. Because all of his ideas, they're not all terrible.
No, they're not. They're not all bad. But the reason that he's a little different than Ron Paul, he was a true outlier in his party.
Yeah.
I really don't think most of the Republican Party agrees with what Ron Paul wants to do. Like, I think that they look at his ideas about getting rid of the Federal Reserve or ending the drug war or legalizing drugs or going back to the gold standard. I think those really are, like, outlier ideas. I don't think they really want to do what he wants to do. So Ron Paul's belligerence and his attitude and his roguishness, that kind of made more sense because he really could not depend on the Republican Party to do what he wants. Bernie, he's not that far apart from most of the Democratic Party. Like, he's not as far apart as he thinks he is. He thinks he's like a real rebel and a visionary, and his ideas are pretty much the same ideas they've had for 100 years. I mean, they're not really that from what they've been championing for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's not a member of the Democratic Party, but I mean, he's championing ideas that the Democratic Party have pushed for.
This is kind of a criticism of Bernie that people who know him pretty well, they kind of talk about him like, you know, people think he's a really humble guy and really down-to-earth guy, and they kind of talk about he has a big ego. Like, he sort of has more ego and more arrogance than people would think. I was trying to think about Bernie, and I was like, one thing that people never say about him, like, I never hear this word associated with him, is arrogance. But he kind of is arrogant. But I don't ever hear people say that. Like, I hear people go around the world to be like, he's too idealistic, or he's socialist, communist, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you hear he's too old, he's this, he's this. But I don't ever hear people really attach the word arrogant to him. The reason that he's so reluctant to step out of the race and really kind of give it to, like, okay, Hillary, it's you, and I'm just going to be here all supporting you, it's the same reason he's never been a Democrat. Like, he's kind of been an independent until he had to run for president. Kind of what you're saying, where he thinks he's the only person who can do this. Like, he thinks it all comes down to him, and the whole thing is his ball game. And he sort of has an inflated sense of himself. And I think we see this with a lot of people who are independent. Like, I think Pat Buchanan, when we look at Pat Buchanan and Ross Perot and Ron Paul and Ralph Nader and Bernie Sanders, they're all different, but they've all kind of got that I'm an old man who thinks I'm the only person who can save America thing. But people are not going to say Pat Buchanan and Ron Paul and Ralph Nader and Ross Perot and Bernie. Like, politically, they don't have really that much in common. Except maybe Ralph and Bernie, but politically they're kind of far apart on a lot of different things. But when it comes to, like, their personality styles and this, like, idea of I'm the one, I'm the guy who's going to do it or whatever, I think you find this with a lot of third-party candidates. And, I mean, one of the original titles for this episode of the podcast was No Country for Old Men, because we keep getting these older, independent candidates to run who really feels like it's a part of its ideology, but a lot more of its ego.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Although, it's hard to tell the difference between Pat Buchanan and Bernie Sanders. I don't see where their ideologies don't line up.
Right. Pat, he's another guy who, he was a Republican one cycle, the next he was an independent. He did what Bernie does, where he goes in and out of the party, depending on what the party allows him to do. So if the party's backing him or they give him a place, he's there because it's easier. And if they say, well, we're going to back the incumbent president, I'll run as an independent. Fuck you. And so he kind of goes out on his own way. So we've seen a lot of men like this. I don't feel they get deep enough into the psychology of these people. I think they talk about their issues and their ideologies and all that's well and good, but who a person is really important to knowing what kind of president they would be or what kind of politician they are. And I think with a lot of these guys, there is a fear of mortality. I think you get to be at a certain age because they were all pretty old when they were running for president.
Yeah.
Bernie, if he did win, he'd be the oldest president we've ever had. And I think you get to be at a certain age and you kind of start, how do you deal with mortality and the end of times and all this stuff? And I think a certain kind of guys, I'm going to be president. Like, you strive for greatness in that last minute. And Bernie has, I'm not trying to be a total dick, but for about 30 years, he's pretty much sat on his ass. I mean,
yeah.
He's the backbencher in Congress. He doesn't really have that good of a legislative record. And Bernie fans, they are screaming at their laptops. Like, they are going apeshit because they would go on and on about the 400 bills he sponsored that mattered that only three of them passed. But when you really look at senators in Congress, he's not really that notable. Like, he wouldn't be in the top 10% of people who have really accomplished a lot and gotten a lot of legislation passed. I think he's dealing with that fact of mortality and, like, his legacy and what did I contribute and, like, how can I beat the Grim Reaper with I'll become president. For him, it makes a lot of sense, and it's a good move. I'm not an old man yet, but I'm sure when you get to be that stage, you're thinking about, I'm going to die. Nobody's going to remember me. My legacy, what's it going to mean? How are the next generation going to remember me? And what better way than to become president? Because everybody learns the names of the presidents. And I know a lot of his fans would really, really, really get mad at me for saying that Bernie basically portraying him as vainglorious or kind of his presidential run as a vanity project, but it kind of is. And I mean, if we're being totally honest, I mean, people say, no, it's the issues. He and Hillary voted the same way 96% of the time when they were in Congress. They're not that fucking different. Like, they're really not like a world apart. They're not different enough that he should still keep running for president and be pulling out all the stops to keep her from being the nominee. There's nothing about her that should be that ideologically offensive to him. And the fact that he's pulling out all these stops and really trying to stop her and really seems to think it would be a disaster if she were the nominee, I think it's more of a personality thing than really ideology.
See, that's what gets me the most is, you know, he's sitting here talking like, you know, she would come in and destroy the world. He's the only person that can save it. When really, like you said, I mean, they are, for the most part, they have the same political stances on most things. Yeah, he wants a $15 an hour minimum wage. She said $12.
When you get deep inside the Democratic Party, they're sort of splitting hairs. Like, the debate between Hillary and Bernie about should it be $12.50, should it be $15, should we have a public option or single payer, should we have paid maternity leave or extra long paid maternity leave? I mean, these are things that you're really splitting hairs. But to the Republican Party, all these things are toxic, and they don't want any of this stuff. And the most moderates, they're kind of looking at it like, we want all the stuff Bernie's saying, we don't want to pay for it, basically. Like, we don't want a deficit, and we don't want a tax increase, and we don't want the size of government to increase. And most people, you say, what does that mean to you? They can't really tell you what that means. They just know Republicans have branded big government with evil, so they can't really get in depth about why they have such reservation towards the federal government getting bigger and bigger. I hear people say, I want the liberals, but they need to embrace a more free market style or privatization style or, like, more capitalist solutions or whatever. So in that way, I think Hillary is better because what she wants is essentially what Bernie wants, but she's going to figure out a way that it looks more appealing to a country that has always really had a lot of pride in being the most capitalist country on earth. And so you sometimes have to trick Americans into a program that's for their own benefit. Like, if it paid for all the schools, but it somehow got Mark Zuckerberg to pay for it, that would be preferable to anything. So you got to kind of trick people into this stuff. His whole approach is wrong. I mean, when I hear Bernie talk, he talks a lot about the industries that he doesn't like. He talks a lot about the companies he doesn't like. But I don't really hear him say, well, here's what this company's doing. Here's how they all should do it. I don't hear him single out a lot that he likes about our economy. When you shit on Walmart, that's fine as long as you finish it with, they could do what Costco does. But I think he leaves that last part out. Like, I mean, I know...
Yeah.
He'll give a token mention to a good company, but it feels like, here's what's wrong, here's what's wrong, here's what's wrong. And I think his whole approach is government first, second, and last. And government has to do everything. I've written articles about a lot of Bernie's so-called working class revolution. It doesn't actually have anything to do with people who are currently working. Like, it's people who are retired or they're about to retire, spending Social Security and Medicare, or it's like free college for people who are going to work. I mean, if you're between, as we are, the ages of 25 and 55, he doesn't have a lot of solutions. I haven't heard him say anything about job creation. Hardly nothing.
No.
A lot of his job creation ideas are, I'm going to increase infrastructure spending.
Rebuild the infrastructure.
I don't know about you, Michael, but I don't want to work construction.
I had my share of that for a couple of years after high school. I did my time.
Yeah,
so.
Right. I mean, and we should. Like, nobody's saying that we shouldn't, because, like right now, seeing this Flint, Michigan shit, we ought to rip up the pipes right now and start rebuilding the pipe network. I mean, because apparently about a quarter of America is drinking toxic water from lead pipes. So I definitely think that there is room for infrastructure improvements. And, of course, there's all kind of bridges that are not up to code, and there are roads that are falling down. But it's not going to be enough to basically keep the world's largest economy going. I mean, you cannot have these
jobs. There's only so many bridges.
Well, there's only so many people who want to work construction. There's an entire economy based around that. The thing with Bernie a lot of times is that he talks a lot about this stuff that I don't think he truly understands. Because he talks a lot about economics and a lot about wages and income inequality and bringing manufacturing jobs back and the evils of free trade and NAFTA, but he's not that knowledgeable about it. And that's been proven from when they asked him exactly how he would break up the banks. Break up the bank! Yeah, but how would you do it? You break them up? He didn't really know what to do. And I think when they get into the weeds of what is your economic plan for job creation, and he kept going back to like these manufacturing jobs that left years ago, and he kind of kept hitting that point home and saying, well, if private industry won't create these jobs again, we'll create them through infrastructure spending by building bridges and railroads and you should do that. But that's still getting back to a type of economy that is a very small fraction of the economy. Like, it's not the entire economy. And since we've shifted from a manufacturing-based economy to a service-based economy, whenever people bring that up to Bernie, he said, well, there's nothing wrong with the manufacturing economy. And we can all go back to the 1950s, and we can all go back to the 1930s. He's sort of lost in that FDR period and also a little bit the Eisenhower period, where the rich people paid 90% in taxes. The government used all that tax money to basically fund a lot of infrastructure projects.
Yeah.
Everybody was happy. That would be great, but when you're trying to aspire to that, you can't base your economic policies on nostalgia. Like, you can't basically take a time machine back to what conditions used to be. Keep in mind that at this time of FDR and Eisenhower, the rest of the civilized world was destroyed from World War II. So if you tax the DuPont business people at 90%, it's not like they could threaten to go to England or France or Japan. Fuck, half of Japan was radioactive. China and Russia, even though they were technically victors in World War II, they had mostly been destroyed and decimated.
Yeah.
Europe, I don't even need to say anything about the Blitzkrieg. So you had an entire world economy that was being rebuilt, and America barely had a scratch on it from World War II. We were the only industrialized power that was out there. Plus, the entire rest of the world had to be rebuilt. So our manufacturing economy made total sense because they had to buy all the shit that they had to replace, like all their stuff that was destroyed. Oh, let's do construction from America. Let's buy American cranes. Let's buy American this, American that. And we were the only place in town to really get the equipment they needed to rebuild it. So that was a great time period for us. But what he's talking about now, raise taxes 90% on Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs can go to the Cayman Islands. They can go to Ireland. Pharmaceutical companies are already doing that, where some of them go to Ireland. And that's not to say that we shouldn't raise taxes on the wealthy. They do have to go up. But if you go up by what he's talking about, I don't think that's really going to help us long term. Really, he's trying to change the way we think about the economy, because for hundreds of years, the Americans have not really thought that much about, well, the government can create health care and things like that. We've thought about how can we get a good enough job to be able to afford these things on our own? By not focusing more on job creation and the actual working class, Bernie forgets the part of working class is working. You have to underline the word working. He told most of the people, well, we've got it to where you could quit your job and you could make $200 a week, or we've got it to where you could make a better job work. They would choose the second one. They would want a better job. They would want a job with better benefits and pay and all that stuff. A lot of his solutions, they're so government-focused. The infrastructure spending, what's that? But taking government money to hire people. I think fundamentally Bernie has a distrust of the private sector, and that's not to say that they don't do shady things. Could write a fucking encyclopedia about the Koch brothers and their there's a lot of things wrong with America. The fossil fuel industry is at the top of the list. I mean, Walmart doesn't pay enough people. Amazon may be single-handedly sinking the economy. There's a lot of things wrong with corporate America and the private sector, but fundamentally, his idea is that you can just raise taxes on all these companies and then the government can hire people. And it goes back to a fundamental distrust of the private sector and not even really wanting to loop them in on job creation, which I think even a lot of moderate Democrats would think is a mistake.
Yeah, I think so too.
When we look at Bernie's ideas, I mean, the second part of, was he Ron Paller a political poet? When I say political poet, a lot of people that like Bernie, Susan Sarandon, Tim Robbins, people, maybe they weren't around in the 60s, but you kind of imagine that they would be hippies if they were, that whole kind of thing. Bernie is sort of a throwback to that 1960s, 1970s type of liberal. When the Democratic Party basically was at its least popular point, is where he's a throwback to.
Yeah.
Before he was on Nixon, won in a huge landslide. From the time Nixon took over to the time Clinton took over, that was only 4 years of a Democratic president, Jimmy Carter. He was the only 4 years we had of it, and that was only because Nixon had been so corrupt that he had to resign. But the Republican Party pretty much dominated from the late 60s to the early 90s.
Yeah.
And I think Bernie kind of harkens back to that age when Democrats, they had their ideology and they had their goals and they had their dreams and their utopia, but what they didn't have was an elected office. And what they didn't have was power.
Yeah.
And they were so far outside of the power structures that they could be like Bernie is because they didn't have to worry about winning. They didn't have to worry about, like, actually winning an office or managing an office. So they could be way out, like, they could be where he's at. And I think a lot of the nostalgia for him, Bernie's a political poet. He doesn't have to worry about really governing or managing anything because he's still in that period where the Democrats, they were just kind of off to the fringes a little bit.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The Democratic Party during that time, I mean, like you said, they were powerless during the 70s, especially the 80s with the Reagan Revolution coming in. I mean, the Democratic Party was non-existent pretty much.
History constantly repeats itself. And when you go back and look at, like, what happened to the hippies, well, they kind of became the yuppies.
Yeah.
The hippie generation, they sold out in the, like, Reagan era, basically, and became the yuppies or whatever, which is why people like Bill Clinton, they had to come in as part of the new Democrats, right? So they had to come in and be like, the old ways are not working, and nobody supports this anymore, and we've got to find the third way Democrats as well. And it was kind of about a new path that you weren't Newt Gingrich, but you weren't quite George McGovern either. It was sort of a between. So I think that the hippies became the yuppies, and then the children of the yuppies were the hipsters.
Yeah.
So these things always repeat themselves. People go, God, these hipsters, they drive me nuts. I hate these hipsters. Before that, it was the yuppies. People didn't like them. And before that, it was the hippies. People didn't like them. And if you go back probably to the 1920s, like the Great Gatsby generation, it was the flappers, the Gilded Age. So there's always been kind of like a certain segment of the youth population that really drives people nuts because a lot of the hippies were pretty privileged.
Mm-hmm.
They came from a background where they could avoid the Vietnam War. And hipsters are, there's always been that segment of the liberal political parties in the liberal age where there's a certain elitism that comes with a certain segment of, I hate whenever some of that Ted Cruz says New York values and sneers, but I know what he's playing on, right? He's basically playing on this Gilded Age, hippies, yuppies, hipster, kind of like this class envy. When he says New York values, people think he's talking about abortion and gay marriage and things like that, and he is. I mean, he absolutely is, but it goes a little deeper than that. It sort of plays on this class envy of myself. I live in Los Angeles, and there's some places that I can't go because I'll throw up. They're so snotty. It's wearing like the $200 sweatpants. Like, they're dressed down, but it's still a very expensive kind of dress down, you know? Like, it's only in a hipster neighborhood can a bunch of people dressed like hobos basically make you feel insecure what Ted is hitting at. I think that's the subtext. Like, there's all the culture war shit on the surface where it's abortion and gay marriage and transgender and all this stuff, but I think when you really get deep into the marrow of a lot of really conservative people, there's a class envy thing. There's a lot of things about, like, well, gay marriage and all that stuff, those are not just liberal values, but those are values of people who left me behind economically a long time ago, and they don't understand my world anymore.
Yeah.
I don't think Bernie is necessarily going after that demographic. I think a lot of Bernie's fans, they've studied this, and a lot of them are a little bit better off than we would think they are. Like, a lot of that, like, I think we would think about a Bernie fan as like Skid Row or something because of what Bernie talks and talks and talks about. And they, some of them do have economic hardships, but a lot of his most vocal fans are, they're not really that bad off, really.
Right.
That just kind of is the further reiteration of what we've always seen of this certain segment of the liberal movement. They really think that they're revolutionary. revolutionaries and rebels, and they're going to bring down the system. And then you look at the Weathered Underground, and like half those kids were rich. And there's always been that kind of a like, yeah, man, fuck the system, fuck the man. And it's like, you mean fuck your dad who paid for your college and you got like an Ivy League degree from Harvard? I think we've all seen that top, that professor top on campus. I could not be a professor on Harvard who's like, you all are sheep and this and this. And he's talking about consumerism and how we're all slaves to it. And I'm like, well, we're from Alabama and our high school had batshit dripping from the ceiling, and you're a tenured professor at Harvard making $250,000 a year. Then you can come lecture me about, I like to go out to eat every once in a while. Like, yeah, I guess I'm a slave to consumerism as I live in a shitty apartment across from your mansion. And I mean, it feels like that kind of a hectoring, lecturing. I mean, a lot of it is people who have it pretty fucking good, and they're kind of lecturing people who don't about how they should be living.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I don't want to name any names, but you might see somebody in Hollywood being like, here's what Alabama's got to do. And I'm like, what do you mean what Alabama's got to do? The money comes from Wall Street. The media is based in New York and L.A. The Washington, D.C. Power Center is there. What's created the income inequality in America? That didn't start in Alabama, just to be honest. You don't have anything to do, really, to Hollywood or a New York liberal. Their kind of mindset is, when they think about who's ruining America, they picture like a redneck and he's got a John Deere cap or maybe a hard hat.
Yeah.
They used to be the hard hats, right? So back in the 60s, the hippies used to fight the hard hats, right? And then now it's like the hipsters versus the hillbillies and shit. Like it's the people who go buy like 10 other ice cream cones and they wear top hats and they've got, you know, handlebar mustaches and they've got like a boyfriend and a girlfriend. Like, we don't want to define it. We've got a group orgy going on. There's five people who meet up and we get together. And it's like them versus like a fucking redneck, like a dynasty guy or something.
Yeah.
And that's the way that they phrased it. And I think problem with looking at it that way is you're basically casting a person who is a villain, doesn't really have any more power than you do. Probably has less power, actually, if you think about it. So I think a lot of times the liberal conversation has cast a certain type of a villain. I mean, we all know the kind of guy we're talking about. You and I grew up with them. These guys, we could go back to our hometown next week or 10 years from now, and all they've got going on is, I mean, they like to go hunting. They like to collect a bunch of guns. They like getting drunk. They like having a pickup truck. Simple stuff.
Yeah.
And I think when you're casting that guy as the face of the oppressive movement, you're really missing it, because it's like, that guy's not powerful.
Yeah.
He doesn't have media power. He doesn't work in advertising. He doesn't schedule the TV shows. He doesn't cast movies for Hollywood.
And most of the time, he doesn't even know a news station.
Yeah, a news station or anything like that. I mean, yes, they vote, and they might vote for somebody like Roy Moore, and I think Roy Moore's a bastard. Roy Moore's probably the worst guy in Alabama, but let's be honest. Roy Moore is not what's wrong with income inequality in America. Like, Roy Moore is a fucking Alabama Supreme Court justice, and yes, he's making gay people's lives in Alabama worse in 100 different ways, but he's not what's really driving up this income inequality and these things that people think about and talk about. A couple of months ago, when the controversy about the Oscars so wide and why don't the Oscars nominate more black people and why don't movie studios cast more black people in movies, rednecks don't control movie studios. I hate to tell people that. So when we think about John Deere America, that doesn't really have anything to do with why there weren't any black people nominated for Oscars. And when you look at the people getting all the film roles, it's British people. It's white British people and white Australian people. In the last 10 years, I could name maybe three Southern actors who have gotten big. And in the last 10 years, I could name 100 Australian or UK actors.
Yeah.
But people don't draw that connection. 15 years ago, they said, there's not enough black and Hispanic people in movies. You got to make this more diverse. They go, we're on top of it. We're going to cast British white people. They're like, wait a minute. That's not the diversity we were talking about. When we said we wanted diversity, we didn't mean go overseas for your white people. But nobody connects that. Nobody says, well, literally every actor in England who's worked a shit has become a movie star in America, and black and Hispanic people can't get hired, and nobody connects those two things. When you're casting a villain that is, and the dynasty guys are a bad example because they actually do have a little bit of power. But I think most people that hate the transgender laws and the gay marriage laws and the income inequality in America, the villain that they cast is more like this faceless redneck. It's more like this generic hillbilly America kind of guy. Their thinking is, even if that guy's not personally powerful, he elects these Tea Party congressmen that come to Congress Congress, and they basically have taken over, and that's what's running America in the ground. I think income inequality is a lot bigger than that, because even though the voters may be what we're talking about, the people who finance those people, Wall Street billionaires, Silicon Valley moguls, I mean, the conservative money, most of it doesn't come from Alabama. It comes from Texas or California or New York or wherever the Koch brothers pretend to live, even though they really live in New York. You keep coming to like a backwoods town for your villains and really maybe go across the street to the hedge fund.
It's easy to target somebody, you know, like what you're saying, these hometown hillbillies. It's easy to target them because it's easy to make fun of them. Go make fun of some wealthy CEO somewhere, and it's like, he's the cause of it. Well, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, I know.
Look at my wife. Look at my cars. Look at my girlfriend.
Yeah.
You're just jealous.
I know a lot of Bernie people listening to this would probably be like, well, assuming that there are any who listen, I don't know that there would be who would listen to this this far. Like, the second they see the title, they'd be like, nope, not listening to that. And then if I think I might do that. For the title, I'm going to put Bernie is Jesus Christ reincarnate. And, then they'll listen to it and be like, wait a minute. He tricked us. Sly Fox, Alabama. But if they were listening to this, they would hear what we're saying and go, this is why you should be for Bernie, because he's going to go after the hedge fund people and the billionaire people. And they would listen to what I've said in this podcast and basically say, you tied yourself in a loop. Because the first half, you're talking about Bernie, he's too much for government solutions, and he's too anti-corporate, anti-capitalist. And on the next half, you're saying corporate America and the capitalists, they need a bigger share of the blame for what's wrong. And I get what they're saying, but it's like, you can basically be nuanced. Like, you can basically say that Hillary Clinton is going to be more likely to affect change of what you really care about because she's not so ideologically tied up in, like, for a lot of people like Bernie, they're too ideologically tied up. And we can see that from his record. I mean, when we go back and look at his record, there's been all these bills he refused to vote on because they had a clause he didn't like in it. The naturalization bill, he didn't like a clause in it, so he didn't vote for that. And the Brady bill, he had something he didn't like. And I mean, there's always going to be flaws. And I think you have to take progress when you can, where you can. If we'd have had somebody like Bernie say, no, we're not going to pass Obamacare because if it doesn't have a public option, it doesn't have single payer, I wouldn't have had health insurance. Like, literally. Like, I mean, I'm not exaggerating. Like, for about 5 years, I would not have had health insurance. What's that old phrase? Don't let good be the enemy of perfect or something like that. Is Obamacare perfect? No, but it is better than what we had before.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying just ties all together. And you talked about earlier with the Democratic Party splitting hairs. I think this is the perfect example of where Hillary and Bernie are different and how they would be different candidates. Bernie wants a change, a fundamental change all at once, and thinks that the only way to get there is to just one jump and you're there. Whereas Hillary is looking at it, we're going to make incremental steps and get there eventually, but we're going to take these incremental steps and take what we can get when we can get it and eventually get to the goal. Whereas Bernie's saying, no, we're going to skip all those steps and get straight to what we want. And that just doesn't work.
Well, no. It works in a third world country with a dictator.
Yeah.
But what doesn't work is America, because, I mean, America, have we ever done anything all at once and immediately? I mean, ever?
Yeah.
You know, like, when you look back at our history, I mean, hell, it took 100 years to end slavery, 100 years to end segregation. I mean, like, and these are things that most people didn't like. These are things that didn't even benefit most people.
And, like, looking at World War I and World War II, it's like, war breaks out. Let's just kind of save ourselves.
Right. World War One was literally almost over before we even got there. World War Two, it had been dragging on, and all these other people had been fighting it, and then America kind of shows up at the end. The only example I can think of a rash action was the war in Iraq, and we saw how well that turned out. Whenever America does do something rash and kind of like unprovoked, and it's usually terrible. So I think too big. I mean, America is the third largest country in the world in terms of population, so it's got the third largest population in the world.
Yeah.
But unlike China, it's not a dictatorship. So, like, we also have a form of government where you can't just, the government, you just can't do things so immediately. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily a good thing, because a lot of times America does move way too slow. Classic example. And again, Bernie's big mistake is thinking that he and Obama are really that different. It's just that Obama's like, I'm not master of the universe. I'm not Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen. I can't snap my fingers and then it just all happened. So a classic example was Obama wanted to build that wind pipeline. Like, he was basically going to have it where Oklahoma, they get a lot more wind, and he was going to build this pipeline to where that would help power the Southeast, basically. They had talked about this, and they had talked about this, and they had tried to get approval, and people had stonewalled this for like a decade, basically, almost. And Obama's like, no, we're going to do it. Even after he said that, like, that seemed like decisive action. It still was like, we're going to start 2 years from now. We're going to finish maybe 8 years from now. Even though that looked like decisive action, it took a decade to get where he finally got to where he's like, no, let's do it. And then even now, it's going to be a decade before it's finished. And of course, in China, it's like, you know what we need? A new rail system. Bulldoze this village tomorrow, you know, and they'll just fucking like dislocate people. I mean, if there's a town in the way, that town's out of the way. And they're like, get lost, you know, like they just move these people. The government moves like a hot knife through butter. I mean, they really do whatever they want to do. And of course, in America, you could never do that here, ever. Because look at the damn conservatives. When you say, we're going to raise income tax from 34% to 35%, but tyranny, tyranny. They think that, I mean, whenever I see these the libertarians on TV, I'm like, you're the most spoiled ass fucking children I've ever seen in my, you don't know what a big, you don't know what an oppressive government is. You don't really know what it is. People in America, you see that idiot, Nick Gillespie, leather jacket, he's so fucking cool. The guy's like 50 or whatever, and he's always talking about libertarianism, big government. You don't know what a big government is, you fucking joke. Yeah. Like, you don't know what oppression is, you don't know what fascism is, you don't know what government tyranny is, and you hear people talk about, well, what's your version of tyranny? Well, there's an estate tax. Oh my God. People at Bernie and people at the Kochs, they're never going to see eye to eye ever, 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 because the Kochs, I mean, you'd think the Koch brothers would get to a point where they're like, hey, we're the 10th richest people in the world. Maybe we can be happy. No, never. They're never going to be happy.
No, it's more like, we're the 10th richest people in the world. How are we going to pass those other 9 bastards?
You're exact. Why are we only 10? We should be second. No, we should be first. Who's, who do we have to get? You're exact. You're so funny. That's exactly right. They'll be on their fucking deathbed. What's my portfolio look like next quarter? And then they'll flatline and the damn line will go straight. I mean, people like them are why we actually need people like Bernie a little bit. Because people like the Kochs would eat and eat and eat until they explode. They would eat until they've sunk the world because it's never enough. It's never going to be enough. Right now is the best time in human history to be rich. Right? Because you're not only rich, there's no diseases, you got jet planes, you got helicopters, you can't get anywhere. I mean, back in the 1930s, you could have been the Rockefellers, you had to take a damn train everywhere, couldn't get anywhere fast. I mean, right now is the best time in human history, really for everybody, but especially for rich people, because there's no polio, there's no diseases, and then you're like, I want a mistress in Shanghai. Let me get in my private jet and fly to Shanghai. You know what else I'd like? I'd like to have a brothel on a boat, and they just have a yacht with a private harem or something floating out in the Mediterranean. Peter Silicon Valley nutcase, he's like, I want to build my own island. He's building like a giant oil platform out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean because he doesn't want to pay taxes. Relocate to this man-made oil platform that he's going to pretend is an island. It's called like Seasteading. It's going to be a libertarian haven. People can do anything they want. They can bend their guns and not pay taxes. And I'm like, oh yeah, wow, that sounds great. So you're going to be having an orgy with a bunch of guns around. Well, what could possibly go wrong? But basically, people like the Kochs, when you look at it and say, so you not only have it better than 99% of America now and 99% of the world now, you have it better than 99.999% of people in human history. So what do you think about? My taxes are too high. It's like, oh, fuck you. I mean, you get it better than 99.99999%. I'd rather be a Coke than Julius Caesar. But now it's into the grave.
Yeah.
They're still bitching about their fucking tax rate. I mean, it's just like, Jesus. What's your number one concern for the future? There's too much regulation. They won't let me dump sludge in the lake. I want to pollute more than I get to. It's like, oh, my God. Jesus. They had white people problems on Twitter. Talk about billionaire problems. I mean, Jesus. But I think we're going to see Bernie for, I mean, I was hoping this would be the last time we talk about him, but you think we'll see him at least till the convention?
Oh, yeah, I think he's going to the convention. I think Hillary knows that, too, and came out a couple of weeks ago after a big win in New York. And she basically said that, you know, she was congratulating Bernie on such a well-fought campaign and all. Basically saying, Bernie, you're done with. And somebody asked her about him dropping out, and she was like, look, I mean, he says he's going to the convention. I stayed in until the convention when I ran 2008. If that's what he wants to do, then whatever. That's, you know, his right to do so. And, you know, I think she's annoyed by it, but then again, she can't come out and say it. I don't see him leaving, though. I think he'll be at the convention. I think he won't shut up about trying to have a say on the party platform. He's going to make a big fuss over
what's included and all of this before he finally gives in.
Bernie Sanders, folks, the new Ron Paul or a political poet. Send off in the comments and let us know. Thanks for listening, everybody.